much, Chris. Brian said to me, choose 8 photos from the exhibition. How do you reckon you'd go if you could only choose 8 out of all those beautiful photos, and they're the 8 that we're going to chat about? But we managed to do it.
We did. A lot of thought.
So,
and some of these pictures are probably, to put a not too fine a point on it, they're the smaller pictures that may have... Is this on?
Apparently.
Hello? Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Right up there. Right, okay. We're going to talk about some of the pictures which have less, probably... they're less effective as a picture, but they've got more of a story. Mm. Okay?
So, the first one. Beetle Nut Cellars. 6 Mile Market, Port Moresby, 2013. Now, Brian... can you just take us to this market? Paint the picture for us. What's going on in this market on that day in Port Moresby?
Right, this market is 6 Mile Market. It's near the airport in Port Moresby. I was doing a story, words and pictures, about the ban of selling betel nut in Port Moresby. The Governor, Powers Parcott, decided that... chewing betel nut was a disgusting thing, and he started to ban it. He didn't take into consideration that it was part of the PNG economy, mostly by low-income residents who got by selling betel nut on the side of the road or at the market or whatever. So the ban by Parcott was had a distinct effect on the population of Papua New Guinea, in particular Port Moresby. So I was doing a story on this ban, words and pictures, and going around to various markets in Port Moresby where they sold betel nut, and documenting it. Well, I know that 6 Mile Market was one of the buai, which is what they call betel nut markets, and I also knew it was one of the most dangerous places in Port Moresby. I'd been there before for various other reasons and been warned off by the residents who told me you're in danger just being here because there's people here that will take everything you've got on a whim, right? But I really needed this this photograph. So I turned up and this is basically on the edge of the market. It's on near the road. They turned up, and these various people in the picture turned up and said, "You're not safe here, go." I said, "I'm not going until I've got a picture." So basically, these people surrounded the stall, which is run by this husband and wife and their child, and basically, if you like, protected me while I took the picture. And I really like this picture. I love the look on the faces. I love the look on the. I love the surrounding people over the top. And it did get a run, which is good, but...
considering you risked your life for it, I'm very glad it did get a run.
Well, I won't say I risked my life. I probably risked my property and probably a bit of injury, but...
were you frightened, Brian, in that market?
No. It's a funny thing. When you're after a photograph, your personal safety... is not immaterial, but it probably takes a little bit of a back seat. Mm. Yeah, well, you know, I know it sounds ridiculous, but that's the way it is.
Was that about 4:30 in the afternoon,
Ron? Yeah, it was actually. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wanted to get back to the hotel and have a drink. Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Fantastic, thank you.
The buai ban actually didn't last. Good, thankfully, because honestly, it was really affecting the marginal people in Papua New Guinea. After a couple of years, the ban was ignored, and they're back now selling buai on the streets. And 6 Mile Market was actually closed about 2 years after I made this picture, for lots of reasons. One was because it was dangerous, and two is because they were selling buai. But it was reopened in April this year.
We're going to stay in Papua New Guinea and meet this lady. This picture is called Pamuk Mary. It was taken in Port Moresby in 2014. Now, Brian, tell us about this young woman who is a sex worker, which is an illegal way to make money in Papua New Guinea.
It is.
What can you tell us about her?
Right, well, I've got to start by saying the previous image and this image, I was allowed to do that basically because of an ex-Cairns Post journalist, Margot Slotkowski, who is now running, she's the editor of a magazine in Papua New Guinea called Lily. It's a woman's magazine. And I wouldn't have been able to do this if Margot hadn't said, one, I can stay at her place, and two, I can use her car, and three, I'll publish it and pay you, right? Both these photographs, this one and the last one, ended up in being published around the world, CNN, Daily Mail, places like that. Okay, but without Margot's help, I couldn't have done it. Now, I told Margot that I'd like to do a story on the sex industry in Papua New Guinea. Women are treated like not very well in Papua New Guinea, and one statistic is that two-thirds of women in Papua New Guinea have at some stage or other been forced into sex or have taken reward for sex, if you like. Mm. So it's an issue which is not widely known,
right?
So this photograph occurred because when I first got up there, I wanted to do the story, and the first place I went to was a brothel in 3 Mile near Barocco, and Margot came with me on the first night. We went there and visited this brothel, she with her partner, Raymond, and we turned up in this brothel. Now, this brothel is like a club, right? It's got snooker tables, it's got a bar, and it plays music, but the girls work there and there's rooms out the back where they go and make their money. Okay? And that night we were accepted, which was really nice. Everybody thought it was great we were there. This particular brothel has a history. In 2004 it was raided by the PNG police, who made an example of the women there. More than example, they raided it, they lined them all up, they sexually abused them, then they marched them down to Barocco police station, where several were gang raped, before being released about a week later. So it was a significant place to go and take photographs. So we went there the first night with Margot and Raymond, and I went back without my camera for about 5 days afterwards and talked to the people in this club brothel, right? This is Helen. She was one of the girls there, and she told me her story. And her story was that she was at a nightclub. How she started in the game, she was at a nightclub and she met a German bloke who gave her a massive amount of money to spend an hour and a half with her. I think it was about 600 kina. I think at that time it was about 230 bucks, which for them was a massive amount of money. And she got into the game because of that. She told me that was the only white person she's ever slept with, but now she sleeps with locals for between $25 and $50 a go, sometimes up to six a day. And that was her story. This isn't taken in the brothel on 3 Mile because it was too... I couldn't take a camera in there and get away with it because half the people there liked me and the other half wanted to kill me. So she took a client to a... it's a hotel where they hire out rooms for an hour at a time and provide you with condoms. And she met a client there, and the client allowed me to take a picture that he wasn't recognisable in, and she was in. So that's how this picture came about. Mm.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian, can I ask, in terms of the backstory,
I've done lots of stories in Papua New Guinea, lots of controversial stories in Papua New Guinea, and we're going to come to one a little bit later on, which is the one that I thought would really get me in lots of trouble. And I hope there's nobody here from PNG in authority, because it doesn't seem, I haven't been kicked out yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if I was. So that's about as much as I'll say to you, Mark, on that one. But we'll come to that a little bit later.
We will. But for now, we're going to go back to Brian's old stomping ground. Let me see if I get this right, Brian. South East London.
South East.
How's that?
South East. It's not bad.
South East.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
This is a photo of a man called Alan Hogg. You took this in Lewisham, London, 2016. The title of the photo is Barrow Boy. So what does that mean in terms of the life that Alan was leading?
Okay. I was back in England with my daughter and Rose, and I visited Lewisham on my own, actually, because I'd like to go back and feel the place, and I wanted to go back and see what I can find of the London and the Lewisham where I was brought up of my home, right? And I found it very hard. I went back to the market, Lewisham markets, where I was, I used to frequent a lot as a kid and as a teenager, and I was looking for the old Barrow Boys. And they're not really there anymore. The markets and the businesses in Lewisham have become multicultural, which is a good thing. But I wanted to find the old Barrow Boys of my youth. And I came across Alan. Now, Alan runs a store there, and the license for his store said simply, license to sell fruit, veggies,
flowers
and Xmas decorations, which I thought was really cute. So Alan was born in Lewisham Hospital, where I was born. He lived in Ladywell, where I grew up. So we had a lot in common. And I asked him, I went up to him and said, Alan, would you mind if I took your photograph? And he said, what do you want to take my photograph for? Bugger off. I thought, oh, well, I asked him again. He said, no. And I thought, okay, fair enough. So I went round the rest of the Lewisham markets, and there wasn't anybody else that I felt like summed up markets and the old Barrow Boy more than Alan. So I went back. I said, okay, Alan, I'm not going until you say yes, sort of thing. And eventually, begrudgingly, he said, okay, all right, you can take a few frames. So basically, I did that, just took a few frames. And I love the look of the gentleman. Yeah. And he is what I remember as a child in Lewisham markets. Mm-hmm. And I got in touch with his family. I got in touch with his family, and then sadly, they told me a couple of years ago that he died, which is really sad. And I remember the last thing I remember was of this day, I'd finished taking photographs, and I was walking over the bridge back from Lewisham into Ladywell, where I came from, over the bridge. And this mobility scooter almost ran me over all the way across the bridge, and it was him, which is really cool. And, so sad that he's gone.
Yeah. So, the life that you led in Lewisham, it was a working class area.
Yeah.
But these days it's what becomes quite
These days,
quite
because
gentrified.
Of the light rail connection between Lewisham and Canary Wharf across the river, which is the business centre of London. Lewisham is now on the up and up, and real estate prices have gone through the roof.
Mm. But I'm just looking at Alan's face and his eyes,
he's got a weariness about him, doesn't he?
It has a weariness that, being a Barrow Boy can't be an easy life.
No.
All those years in the cold, and it's always cold over there.
It was in the old days, it was a community.
Right.
But that community aspect, because of multiculturalism, has deteriorated.
Mm. Well, we'll head off from London now, and we're going to take a trip to Manus Island.
Back to Papua New Guinea. There's a lot of Papua New Guinea in this London.
There is. This is a picture, a photo called 18 Minutes, Manus Detention Centre 2017. Now, you're invited to join this boat,
yeah,
which was full of food and medicine, and to go to the detention centre. Like, journos have been falling over themselves to try and get into this joint. Did you just happen to be at the right place at the right time to
very
get an invitation
so.
Like that to
very
jump on this boat?
Sometimes, yeah. Who said everything's luck? I think Chris did. Yeah, right. This was a bit of luck too. We arrived in, myself and journalist Robert Cannon turned up in Port Moresby the day after that the Australian government had left the camp, deserted the camp, and left 600 asylum seekers with no food, no water, no power, no medical services, nothing. They just abandoned the camp and left them there. And we arrived the day after that happened. It was the next day that we were nosing around a little harbour in Loringal, the capital, and we saw a boat, a little boat, leave. And Rory said first, like, you saw it before I did. He said, look. I said, yeah, bloody asylum seekers on that boat. He went, yeah. So I took a few frames on the long lens as they left, and they glared at me, actually, and I thought, oh, well, there you go, that's life. And they went out a little bit out to sea and then came back again. Oh, we're going to be in trouble here. And they came over and said, are you government? And we said, no, we're media. And they said, oh, all right, do you want to come with us? You're joking. The immediate reaction was Rory and I looked at each other and said, okay, let's have a chat, because we wanted to, you know, just discuss whether this was a moral, this is the right thing to do morally, or, you know, whether it was the right thing to do. And it didn't take...
I was going to say, how long did it take you to say yes?
It didn't take very long to say, yeah, let's go. What's the echo? Yeah. Anyway, so we accepted their invitation. And on the boat from the harbour to back to the detention centre, get his name right, because I've got my notes.
Got his name.
I'm a stickler for, I'm a journalist, I'm a stickler for details. Essatuba, yeah, his name's Essatuba. He was ringing his colleagues in the detention centre to make sure it was okay for us to arrive and turn up. Mm. So we did turn up at the camp, and immediately we got there, it was absolute chaos. We were mobbed by hundreds of asylum seekers, and that in itself was a challenge, because I wanted to take photographs, and I couldn't take photographs when I was surrounded by people. So, to his credit, Ryan, my journalist, engaged as many as he could, and I took off around the detention centre taking pictures. We'd been there what seemed like forever, when we got news that the authorities, the police and the Navy, because it was in the middle of the Navy base, found out we were there and they were on their way. So we had to leave, and we had to leave basically because this boat was crewed by local boatmen, and if they'd got caught there, they'd have lost their boat and they probably would have been beaten, arrested, whatever else, so we had to go. When I got back to Loringal and downloaded the pictures, it worked out I'd only been inside the camp for 18 minutes.
Wow.
Seemed like forever.
Yeah,
and I would have loved to stay there longer. I met Bruce Bachani in there. I'd been communicating on WhatsApp for a couple of years. He'd been a great source of information about what was going on inside the camp, etc., etc. And just as I was about to leave, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, hello, Brian. And it was like, Jesus Christ, hello. It was one of the nicest moments I've had. But I didn't have time to take the picture except as we left.
But you managed to get a lot of photos off in that.
I got a lot of photographs. I got an exhibition out of it, which ran in Sydney and Melbourne, which was very rewarding.
Amazing. We're still in Papua New Guinea. This is Dorcas. She was the victim of sorcery, and Brian took this photo in 2018. Her injuries were horrific, Brian. What can you tell us about Dorcas' story?
Okay. I was with my journalist Cindy Wachner. We were sent up to Papua New Guinea to get as much as we could on Salisbury. We only had about two and a half days to do it. We turned up in Goroka. We found a safe house where people that had been victims were kept. Well, kept is not, well, I suppose they were kept, yeah, for their own well-being. We asked if we could get access, and we were told the first day, no, you can't. The second day we asked again, and very nicely they said, yeah, okay. We turned up at the safe house and we found various, about 8 or 9 victims of hardship caused by Sangoma sorcery. And Dorcas was the one that stood out. She and her sister, Peter, and her son, Harry, had been beaten under accusations of sorcery after a family member died, and they had no idea why. But Dorcas was beaten. She had her arm nearly chopped off with an axe. She had axe wound to her head, and then she was tortured with red hot irons. Somehow, both she and Peter did eventually escape. And it was only a few months, it was a matter of weeks when I took this photograph of her in the safe house. Mm.
So she was a victim of sorcery, Brian, but you know, from what you know of these sorts of attacks, are they being used as an excuse?
Yeah, I mean, there is a belief of sorcery, Sangoma. It's got a basis of belief. So it's not to be dismissed. But more and more it seems to be a crime of, what's the word?
Opportunity.
Yeah, it's a crime of opportunity. So if you don't like somebody, you can spread it around that there's a sorcery implication, and then you can basically do what you like.
Do you know, this was 3 years ago, do you know how?
I'd like to go back and find out, actually, and I've got a couple of others that were in the safe house I'd like to go back and say, but it's a bit difficult right now.
Well, let's come to Australia now, to Arakoon. This is a photo called Generations. Isn't it beautiful? Shot in 2019, it features 2 week olders, Silas and Rebecca Wallby, and their beautiful great-granddaughters. Brian, this photo is now in space. Brian had 3 photos that were shot into space as part of a celebration of our shared humanity, and this was one of the ones that's going to be, I think, was exhibited in space by a big screen and shot into space.
Yeah.
So hopefully one of these days, yeah. Some people.
Well, the file was sent out. The digital file was sent out in a straight line. So God knows where it ended up.
Who knows? Yeah. This image strikes me as such. They're such proud people.
What have you done to it?
But you've met Silas and Rebecca many times.
Yeah.
And what this photo says to me is what they've seen.
Yeah.
As we know, Arakoon has had troubles, and they've seen it all, but they're survivors.
Yeah, they were survivors, yeah, I won't get to that bit. Yeah, Silas and Rebecca have always been a beacon in Arakoon. They're wick elders, they're highly respected across Arakoon, which is unusual because there's warring factions or dissatisfied factions in Arakoon, but they have amazing respect, and whenever I've met them, they've always been forthright. They've always had the best needs of their community at heart, and it was wonderful. And the strange thing about this picture is I forgot what the subject was, but I was up there doing a story on an issue in Africa, and I can't remember which one it was, and I took photographs of Silas and Rebecca and their family, and it was a Courier Mail story, and the Courier Mail used another picture which I thought was very ordinary. And I basically forgot about this one. It was, and then it was about 18 months later when I was going through the archive looking for something, I came across it and went, oh, bloody hell, I like that. You know, and dragged it out again. And I started spreading it around then, and it's got a lot of. It's been receptive well since then, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I guess it tells us about Silas and Rebecca that family has always been everything.
Yeah, it is. It's always been their first. What they really care about is the family and then the community.
And
it's refreshing to see.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
You don't get that in normal society, that sort of perception that we're looking after it, Yeah.
And very sadly, Silas is no
longer
with us.
Yeah, he died a couple of years ago. Mm. I took his family a big print.
That's nice. Well, while we wait for our technicians to bring up the next photo... This obviously is a Photographer's Life Part 2, but it is quite different to Part 1 in a sense that Part 1 was more about the media work that you were doing, whereas Part 2 is quite personal, but it's also you having to get out there and just go for whatever you can because of the changing nature of the media.
Yeah. Part 1 started off with my first photographs, and then it went... I started doing media work really early as a teen. But most of the work in that part one was media work, assigned media work. There wasn't much, I think it was about four that wasn't assigned as a media job. This one's different. This is more work I found through myself or personal observations I've made. And that makes it, for me, pretty different. And I think the variety in this one is a lot more than it was in the first exhibition.
Mm, absolutely. So, part three, is that coming?
Already started on that. I've got a few images already, yeah. I am recycling, right? Yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely photo.
Yeah. I didn't take that one, honestly.
So, should we just imagine the photo that's coming?
No, they're going to do it in a minute. How far away? Yeah.
That far
this
away.
Close.
That far away. Right, question.
Yeah,
yes.
With this documentary style photography that you're doing, how much direction do you allow yourself to give? Like,
as little as possible.
Background, you just say to someone, through, up there, anything like
as
that?
As little as possible. Actually, when it comes to direction of where, not much, because that's important to me that they are in situ, in their state.
Like the ones of
Rebecca and Silas that was taken as they were sitting inside in front of their house.
If there's a completely distracting element that's just annoying you, I don't move the camera, but do you, like in that people that side, if there was someone there that was just out of place, would you just be...
That people nut shot was shot as it was. There was no direction whatsoever. It was, I'm going to get in there, shoot a picture, get out. And I just found what I thought was the best spot and made it. And most of the pictures are that way. There's not usually much in the way of direction because of that was all the moment. Mm. A bit different from what you did.
Slightly.
This is a photo called Ramnami.
There's a bit of direction here.
2019. This image has also been sent into space.
Yeah.
Now tell us, this man is part of an extraordinary Hindu sect, and you may of course notice the tattoos he has all over his body. Tell us about this man.
Right, I can do that easily, yeah. Right. His name is Mahathir Ram Tangon. He's a member of a sect, a Hindu sect called Ramnami Samaj. Now I didn't know about this at all. I was actually in Chhattisgarh, India, with a photographer friend of mine who lives in Mumbai. He's an Indian guy, he's an expatriate in India. And he volunteered to come along with me on a trip to Chhattisgarh to document Adani and what they were doing in the Hastiawaram forest to the Gondi people, right? So we were in Chhattisgarh doing something completely and utterly different. And then Shreen said to me, there is a sect here that they're tattooed. And I went, oh yeah. He said, do you want to go and do it? I went, yeah, God. He said, it will take some finding. I said, let's go and do it. Right. So we had a down day from doing the Adani Gone story. And we took off. And we went into the wilds of Chattisgarh, down these little lanes, into these little villages, trying to find them. It's a small community. Nobody knows how many there are in this sect, but it varies between 20,000 to 100,000 people in this sect. Now, back in the 1800s and into the 1900s and through the 1900s, they tattooed themselves with the name of their god, which their god is Rama, and the tattoo is Ram Ram. So they tattooed themselves, or they were tattooed by their mothers, fathers, or family, completely over their bodies with this tattoo, Ram Ram. And it was to in celebration of their god.
Right.
So it's a small sect. It's highly unusual. The reason they tattooed themselves with the Ram Ram tattoo was because they were a lower sect. They were what's the word?
Untouchables.
Untouchables. They were untouchables, and they did it to annoy higher castes, to show that we're proud of what we are, which is a really nice thing to do. However, if you're a 2-year-old and you get started to get tattooed, you're a 3-year-old and then you're more tattooed, and you're a 4-year-old and more tattooed, I'm sure it's not that special. There's only five, and that's only an estimate, there's five that have got complete body tattoos left alive, and all of those are in their 70s.
Is that because young people, even though they're part of this sect, are like, I'm not doing
that? Well, actually, I did a bit of research. After I spoke to you, I did a bit of research on that. And part of the reason they don't do it now, I mean, the young people now will get a tattoo or a couple of tattoos, same Ram Ram, but they won't be that visible because now they feel they'll be discriminated against and they'll find it difficult to get work.
Right.
All right? So it's disappearing.
And I just wanted to point out, it's not only men,
women
in the sect are fully tattooed as well.
Men and women, yeah. I've got a woman that's similarly tattooed.
Mm. Just the look on his face, the way he's looking out, he strikes me as a man who commands respect.
Very much so. He was very proud to put on his traditional headdress, which is decorated with peacock feathers. And I didn't have a choice in that way, one way or another. He was going to wear it wherever I said. So, he's very proud gentleman. That was taken in the front of his house.
How fascinating. What's it like to meet someone and you know there's only five people left that you know of in living?
Pretty special.
Life.
Pretty excited. Yeah. Pretty
amazing.
Excited. It was a moment where you think, I can't stuff this up. I can't stuff this up. You're worried about it. Was very low light and very slow shutter speeds, and I'm thinking, what? Yes,
don't they have their own economy or
community going? So they live in their own villages.
The reason I ask, if the young ones don't want to be fully tattooed, not being recognised, don't they have their own community working economy?
But as you'd imagine, the children and the people spreading out from those villages now because there's not an awful lot of opportunity, just like they are in the Aboriginal communities here. Mm. So, if you're going out into the larger community, out in the world, you've got to be careful about,
integration.
Like that. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And not being left out. Sorry?
Did he share the story of why his right hand is missing?
Why his right hand is
missing?
Is it? I don't think it is, actually. I think it must be. Yeah, it's probably a bad crop, yeah. It's not missing, it just looks like it is. I don't know what. Don't know how that happens. There you go. I've never even noticed that. Thanks for pointing it out.
So let's move on to our last photo that we're going to talk about, and we couldn't not talk about this amazing woman. I'm sure many of you knew Carol Mayer, or if you didn't, you were inspired by her story. This is an incredible photo that Brian took in 2016 called The Skin I'm In. Brian, just tell us how you developed a relationship with Carol, because it took you quite a while to, you know, work up the guts to actually call her to say, hey, I'd like to take a photo.
Right, yeah. Now, the story goes back to 2011, and I know we're short of time, so I'm going to make this as quick as possible. Right, went back to 2011, I was asked by the Sunday Mail to take a picture of a Carol Mayer, and all I was told was she was a burns victim, and the picture here said, I don't know, but she's got lovely eyes. I turned up to meet Carol, and I was nervous as, and we sat down, had a cup of coffee and had a chat, and said, what would you like to do? And we did various photographs, wearing her favourite scarves and things like that. And but what I wanted to do at the time was get a facial shot, just of her face and the lines on her face and her eyes and her lips, etc., etc. But it took a while to get round to that because I wasn't nervous as I didn't know how she'd take it. But eventually I got this photograph I was really pleased with of Carol's face and an enigmatic look. I was really happy with it, and I filed into the Sunday Mail. They said, you can't use that, it's too confronting. And I was put out by that, because the image was gorgeous, and it won awards all around the planet, and Carol loved it. So I was pretty put out about that. But then I left it at that. And after I had taken in that, those initial pictures of Carol, I had the idea of doing something that showed more of her injuries and more of her in her skin, if you like. And I was too nervous and too scared to go and ask her for a long, long time. And it was eating me away. I just wanted to get these pictures, but I didn't have the guts to go and see her. And eventually, it was a few years, 3 or 4 years, and I just thought, right, I bit the bullet, rang her up and said, Carol, can we have a cup of coffee? She said, yeah, come around and have a cup of coffee. And I went around and said, Carol, I'd like to ask you a question. This is what I'd like to do, and it's entirely up to you. And I quite understand if the answer's no. And she went quiet for a long while, and then she said, yep, I'm going to do it. And I said, okay, Carol, before we go any farther, I have to ask the question, why? And she said, well, I want to show other burn survivors that it's not a sentence to be burned, scarred, that you can do whatever you want, and that's why I'm going to do it. So we did this photo shoot in our home. She was fabulous. I was nervous, she was fabulous. I took a fair few pictures, and they were never published in the newspaper at that time because I did it on my own. But I did spread them around, and they've won awards all over the place, which is very gratifying. But the saddest part of all is Carol, who was just amazing. She spent her entire life from... The most gratifying thing was she told me that my taking photographs of her gave her the confidence to go out into the community, face the public, and advocate for other burns victims, and tell them that you can do whatever you want to do. And I'll never forget that.
That was
really touching. But as you may know, she succumbed to cancer last year, which was devastating for lots and lots of people, including myself. And she's very, very sorry.
Congratulations, the exhibition is extraordinary. Any final questions from the audience? Do we have one? Anyone want to ask, have a burning question for Brian? You can always catch up with him at the bar after.
Yeah, you can always buy me a drink.
You can always buy me a drink.
Ah, yes.
Oh, Dave,
so,
thank you.
Yes.
The books are here.
The books are here. Now, the books are available. It's a large, limited edition collector's copy. And if you work it out, the number of photographs in the book, the cost is $4 a photograph. $4 a page. It's not an awful lot of money. During the exhibition, anybody that orders during the exhibition, it's a special exhibition copy, and your name will be printed in the knowledge in the book, and I'll put my dirty little signature in it as well. Okay. So if you want, if you're interested, shut up, if you're interested, see Dale, she is the one taking your details and whatever, and thank you. Thank you very much.
That was my job to plant the book.
Well, you can do it again if you like.
There's a book. It's got both this exhibition, all the works from this exhibition and part one. There might be a part three.
Yeah, I've got a few images already. I took a couple recently, though. It's going to be dead in there.
All right. Again, apologies for the technical difficulties that we've had, and thank you very much to this man for jumping up and helping us out. This is the first time that we've had a lot of people in this room with a microphone, and so we're still learning. Thank you all for your patience, thank you for coming, and Brian is going to go back into those two rooms. And you can
I'll go in the bar first.
He's going to go in the bar first. And, yeah, buy him a drink. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. All right. If you've got your mobile, my mobile's about dead.